This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Amy Ray and Emily Saliers of the music group Indigo Girls. I spoke with them on August 10th, 2013 at the Wild Goose Festival in Hot Springs, North Carolina. Download the MP3 of our produced show with the Indigo Girls at onbeing.org.
Thanks for hanging in with us, y'all. We're going to talk straight to it, so Krista Tippett and the Indigo Girls.
Are we here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
Emily.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hi. Love your show. Love your show.
Thank you for your patience.
Yeah. All right. So... Okay. Make sure my phone's on silent.
Yeah, your phone's out.
Oh.
Everyone's phone out.
Okay. So, after a biblical rain, the faithful are still gathered. Kind of amazing. And here we are at a festival named after a Celtic Christian metaphor for the unpredictable spirit of God. We have 45 minutes, so we're going to just dive right in. So this festival brings together, it takes place at the convergence of music and spirituality and justice and the arts. And it seems to me that that convergence has been there for each of you for a long time. And I thought, I was asked this question at the beginning of my interviews, whoever I'm interviewing, quantum physicist or a musician, you know, about the spiritual background of their childhood. That I think, you know, so I want to ask that question, but also as you reflect on that, I kind of sense for each of you that music was always in there, and maybe even justice in the arts in that way.
I'll start. Well, my dad is a Methodist minister and a theologian, and he taught at Emory and Candler School of Theology. And so, yeah. Yay, Dad. He's in Germany right now doing something theological over there.
Yeah, you were raised in the bosom of church music.
Yeah. Totally were. Me and my sisters, there were four girls growing up, and we went to church, and we sang in the church choirs, and... But we were also, I think, both my parents, both my dad and my mom, fostered an open environment of discussion and questioning and stuff. So we would go to church, and then we'd come home and ask a lot of questions, usually to dad. And so we had a lot of theological discussion as very, very, very young girls. And then we had music always in the house. We sang in the church choirs, but also mom and dad had a big LP collection. They even had some 33s, I think, from back in the day. And then so we grew up like on Saturday mornings having jazz and classical music in the house and listening to symphonic stuff and church music and all that stuff. So really was our whole upbringing was saturated in music and theological discussion.
And you also spent some time at St. John's Abbey. Is that right, when you were a teenager?
Dad had a sabbatical. I was 14, and we spent a year there in Collegeville, Minnesota.
Yeah, and did you take in some of that chant, some of that singing of the Psalms?
It gave me an appreciation for the power of quiet in spiritual practice, which I think a lot of young folks, or maybe I'll just speak for myself, didn't really understand, well, what's the big idea about being a monk and going and being quiet? What does that do for the world? And it gave me a very, very keen understanding of what it does for the world and for spiritual communities. And so, and then it was just exotic. You know, it was Minnesota. It was cold as hell. And we were in an ecumenical community. And I've always been, I like ecumenical environments, you know, because we never had Christianity shoved down our throats. In fact, my dad had so many Jewish colleagues, and we had just a real Judeo-Christian upbringing as much as a purely Christian upbringing. So anytime I'm in an ecumenical setting, I feel most at home. If I'm going to be in an organized faith setting of any kind, that's the best one for me.
Okay. So, Amy, what about you?
Well, it was a little bit different from Emily, I think, in that it was a more conservative upbringing. My
many of my relatives were Methodist ministers, and my aunt married an Episcopalian minister, priest, and so I grew up with religion all around me, and we spent Sunday mornings, Sunday nights, Wednesday nights, and Friday night youth group. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time at church.
Yeah.
And went to church camp for about 5 years when I was becoming a teenager. And there was music all around. Just we were supposed to learn piano when we were young, and we sang hymns as a family and campfire songs, Kumbaya, and all that stuff, for real. And, they'll know we were Christians by our love. I probably know a lot of them still, actually.
Yeah.
And I was really into church, actually. I had a great youth minister, and I found it to be a place where I could challenge. I mean, my church was very conservative, but my youth group wasn't. And so it was a place of a lot of challenging questions all the time. And I learned a lot when we went on retreats, and you get in trouble, and you just feel you're always kind of pushing your boundaries, you know, and it's a safe place to do it, I guess. But I went on to be a religion major in college, and I thought for one moment that I might actually go to seminary and explore that path. But music was a bigger draw, and I couldn't decide what I would, you know, I couldn't pick one, to be honest with you.
You couldn't pick
between Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism.
Oh, you couldn't pick a religion. I thought you meant you couldn't pick between music and religion.
They're all great, you know, and I really felt that way, you know. So I was raised, you know, in a strongly Christian environment, so I probably relate the most to that culturally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But music was just more of a tug, and I felt like it was just what I was compelled to do.
You know, I was raised Southern Baptist, which I've mentioned a few times this week. So I know, and I in Oklahoma, and it strikes me that that tradition. So a lot of our churches didn't really know what to do with our bodies in general, and a lot of the language was, you know, bodies were entry points for danger, but our traditions really know about the power of music, right? And when I think of, there's so many memories that I have and people I talk to, all kinds of people. And, you know, I remember reading the book that you wrote with your father. You know, music that goes all the way through your body. It's in your cells. It's like you said, you still know those songs today. And I'm just throwing that out there.
What was the question?
Well,
I'm kidding.
You're inspiring me to think out real time. Yeah.
Thinking out loud. It's good.
It's interesting about that fear of the body. Yeah, I mean, I think it just goes back to control, especially controlling women. That's where I think all that fear of the body comes from. And I thought you were going to interject. No, I was just going to say. And the truth is that men have been controlling women for a long time, especially when they get organized. And so...
So do you feel that there was a controlling aspect to church music, too?
Well, I was going to say, my dad worked on sort of the newer Methodist hymnal, and there's a hymn in there with Duke Ellington, Come Sunday. And, you know, we grew up in a very staid... All the hymns were... As you could sort of picture white people sitting straight up and... And I have nothing against white people, but for me always, it was gospel music that, like, especially African-American gospel music, that really was the direct conduit to me and the spirit that I felt moved my life and my actions. And it involved movement of the body. It was sensual because, I don't know, I sort of feel like, generally speaking, when people get all in their heads, it blocks the spirit. Because spirit is not mental, it's spirit.
Yeah.
And the body takes you out of your head and connects you. So once I heard African-American gospel music and was blown away, and the first time I heard it, I was scared because a woman had a spiritual ecstatic experience, although she was crying and jumping up and down, and I was terrified. But that was the body and real life pain experience connect to spirituality, and music brought her to that place. And I'll never forget that day. And then I'll never forget my own journey of appreciating getting out of the head and getting into the body. And so those are just some of my musings on that.
And I think you're right. I think, you know, when I think about the music that I was learning in, like, youth group or spiritual songs, it was interesting because I actually went through a couple of years of being really conservative and going to see Christian rock bands that were not radical left Christian rock bands. They were talking about pro-life and, you know, and I was very influenced by it, honestly. Mm. And we briefly had a moment in our youth group that was very pro-life where I wasn't questioning it. And we would see that film about fetuses and just terrible things. And then I would hear a song that was a pro-life song, and I would be like, oh, I'm pro-life, you know, because it was a folk singer, and, you know, and it seemed so right and hippie-like to be all about love like that. It was so powerful, and I think that just taught me that music can, it's powerful either way, you mm-hmm. know, and that you still have to hang on to yourself in that moment, you know, and know where your spirit is, because it can really influence you, you know, because it does take you out of your context to a certain degree. You know, as soon as I woke up around that, I was like, oh my God, like, you know, that was crazy for me, you know, to have go, but I think I needed to go through it, and I needed to find my own self, you know, within all the different things being thrown at me.
How do you think about the line now for you between sacred and secular music? You know, is there a line? Or you know, in music or in life?
There is a bit of a line for me, because I'll write gospel songs, you know, that are more like Appalachian Mountain gospel songs, and it's that's a sacred song to me, and spiritual in a different way than maybe an unrequited love song might be, or a story song about my family or something. It's coming through me. I don't try to edit it too much. I don't try to make it more complicated than it needs to be. And it's just reserved for singing, you know,
yeah.
and not commercial anything. You know what I mean? I mean, I can put them on records, but it's not the same. It doesn't feel the same to me somehow. I mean, not to say that all the music's not spiritual, but there's definitely for me a place that I go into if I write a little gospel song.
I think that music is a spiritual gift, and then you artists or writers use it how they see fit. So for me, like, I used to draw more of a line between what's sacred and what's secular. Amy actually helped me with this, coming to an evolution of recognizing how sacred what is deemed secular is. And but, you know, I love a lot of rap music, and it's not just rap music. It could be hair bands from the 70s or 80s or whatever. I have a deep objection to misogyny in lyrics and in musical and posturing. And so I can love a genre, but if I hear a song that has that content, I can't separate it from the music. And I don't think that any kind of music that is used to objectify or hurt any person or group of people, type of person, or is a sacred practice. So I mm-hmm. guess I draw the line there.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot y'all were there.
I've also read you saying, talking about finding more of what you wanted in church, sometimes in a smoky bar, than you found in churches, which is a little bit different way to talk about sacred secular.
Well, that's why we spent so much time in smoky bars, I think. I mean, I think, like, with the book that I wrote with my dad, we talk a lot about that, because, like, he cut his teeth on jazz, which is deemed secular, you know, but it really informed his musicality, which then he got the calling to faith, and then he focused on you know, church music and hymnals and things like that. But, you know, when we played in, like, Little Five Points Pub in Atlanta, it was a motley crew of people from all walks of life. And we used to join each other on stage. And we just had this sort of, you know, most of us were dysfunctional in some way or another. But it was very honest.
Are we all dysfunctional
yeah,
in
for
some
real.
Way or another?
But in church, sometimes people pretend that they're not
right.
or that
right.
the message is, like, we're not. Or they're too afraid. Like, it's real hard to get real sometimes in church, the real pain, the real stuff, you know. And a lot of times it's focused on the life to come rather than the life that's right here and what we can do. So, but in those days when we were playing in bars, I mean, my dad and I talked about this a lot. Was like, that is a spiritual experience. And I know the word spiritual gets used a lot, and maybe we don't even know exactly what it means anymore, or I don't, but it was a feeling that people who were very different from each other were all welcome together, very little judgment going on, as I recall, just a hootenanny of people's bolstering each other's spirits through music. And that's, you know, if that's not spiritual, I don't know what it is. So,
when you said a minute ago that Amy helped you see, you helped you think differently about that relationship, can you say some more about
Amy's
that?
Well, Amy's always just been like, you know, I think I had just ideas in my head about what was what. This is this and this isn't this. And Amy opened my, she was more alternative than I was, you know, like she liked music that was more alternative. She liked music that was more raw. I think she had an understanding of real pain and than I did. You know, she was just more evolved about all that stuff and just kind of was who she was. And I learned a lot from her about that. I honestly did, and I still do. And but specifically about the power of music. Like, okay, I'll give you an example. Like, because we were classically trained and we listened to a lot of classic music and jazz and stuff like that, I had an early snobbery about
what's
the best quality music, whatever. And Amy's like, three chords is closer to God. She didn't say that, but. And now I feel that way more than I do the other way, you know? So it was, Amy really helped me with that. And I appreciate that.
I didn't realize how that you had that much snobbery about it.
It was only when I was very young.
Yeah, because you didn't act like it.
But when I was very young, it was like, yep, classical music is the ultimate. I didn't have an appreciation for simpler things that were profound as much as I do now.
I don't usually ask people this question head on, but I feel like you guys can handle it, which is, now you really want to know what I'm going to say, don't you? It's not that. All right, do you think of yourself as religious now?
I mean, I'm very spiritual. I guess in some ways I'm religious too. It's so much the fabric of my life. It's so much the way I think, you know. And I think I took what I think are good things from the church about, and the gospel, you know, and applied them to my life in a way that has worked for me, you know. And I like having that. For me, it's a cultural construct that works really well, you mm-hmm. know. I know there's so many of them, you know, but like I know the one that works for me. And so yeah, I'm not like, you know, I don't go to church a lot. I go sometimes. I really actually wish I went more, to be honest with you, because I really enjoy it. But I get so carried away, you know. I love church, any kind of church.
I just love.
It's interesting to me. The spatial relationships between things, what people say, what kind of hymns they sing, you know, it's all interesting. Like, it's not just intellectual. I mean, it's spiritually interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I find it to be all valuable in this really weird way, and I actually feel less judgmental when I'm in there, even if people hate me and they're radically different from me.
Okay, that's really interesting.
I have this feeling of openness that lets the hate just go off, and I just feel love in the building. It's weird, because I really like nature more. But I'm just like, I think it's from being a religion major or something. I'm really attracted to it, you know, in this weird way. So I do consider myself religious. I do.
I saw someplace, I think it's a video you did, you said you called yourself a queer for Jesus. That's what
yeah.
I am. I'm a queer for Jesus.
That's about right. Yeah. I want like the queer Easter bunny is like the mascot for that, I think. You know? Queer fertility. It's awesome.
I about you? Do you think about yourself as religious?
When I think about the word religious, it has a negative connotation to me, and I think about it as organized, and then I don't feel part of that. For me, whatever, and I feel like the language is always limiting, like.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what I want to get at, because I think the language is limiting for everyone. So I like to, yeah. I like it to ask people to break it open and say what it means or doesn't mean for them.
Well, for me, I'll go beyond the word of religion, because I do think of that in terms of organized. And I think of that in terms of abuse of power, bureaucracy, all that bad stuff, you know, that even is happening in the church today. That, you know, so many avenues that really, like, block you from getting to the source, which is what I want to get to from my own journey. I think that I have such a deep connection to the music that I grew up with in church, the hymns, the sound of the organ, and also, like, because we weren't raised in really, like, any kind of church that made us feel bad. It was kind of thoughtful, like, the sermon was related to the readings, and it was all... And there was a season that was based on the Jewish calendar that was recognized as based on the Jewish calendar, which I always appreciated. And so I like, and with my dad and the people that I grew up with, the theologians, they thoughtfully organized liturgy. Like, they put thought into constructing it so that people might get the most out of it. So I appreciate that, like writing a good paper or something, I guess. If you construct it with care, it's bound to be more effective to the reader or the receiver. So I grew up with that. I like that part of thought and organization and structure in religion. But for me, you know, I have to say that no matter what it's called, and I'll call it God, but to me it's a great benevolent spirit that's much wiser than any of us, my belief, that is involved in the formation of things, the change of things, the evolution of things, is my life is in that spirit's hands. That's what I believe. So it ain't me running things. But that's when language and imagery gets in the way. I don't believe in a puppet God or puppet master God or any of that stuff. So can't even describe it. It's loving, it's powerful, it's wise, it's kind. It's not a mother or a father. It's just this thing that I trust, because this thing has shown me time and time again its wisdom. And that I have my feeble human perception of what wisdom is, but I'm going to go with that.
Uh-huh. I was thinking about what you said about language and stuff being such an obstacle, and what Emily said. It's so funny, because I feel like in some ways I wasn't exposed to religion in that way. I was exposed, like my great uncle was a Methodist minister, and part of his sermon was to do magic tricks. Like, it was, really? You know, it was a very different exposure, and I loved that, you know, and it actually was good for me to see that. But I think we have, and I think as queer people, we also have this. We have this, like, built-in translator sometimes, and I can sit and listen to most sermons, not all of them, but a lot of them. And inside, I'm changing the language in my head as I'm going. I don't even notice it. And I'm getting something out of it. And I'm not sitting there going, it's a patriarchy. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. You know, because I'm just so used to, from such a small age, having to do that to feel okay about myself, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And the same goes for music. You know, we grew up with rock and roll being a white guy's thing, and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and it was really romantic. Yeah. And we had to change all the lyrics in our heads and the imagery and believe that it was okay to be a woman and play music. And you know, I never, like, when I'm in a graceful moment, I don't even think about it. I don't let anything block me. Hmm. Because I have this, like, gift of that, you know, you're given, I think, from the time you're young sometimes, to, like, just translate it as it comes in and make it for you, you know. Hmm. And, I mean, we don't all have it. We can't always do it. You know, I mean, I think we all have it, but we can't always do it is what I mean to say. And it's not necessarily a great thing. Maybe it would be better to, like, be exposed to, like, this incredible intellectual spiritual sermon that felt so accepting of who I was as a woman and a gay woman at a very early age, and feel that. Because I know that when I would go to a different church or have a visiting preacher that would say something like, quote, like, Dostoevsky or something, I'd be like, oh my God, this is so amazing, because it would be something different.
Right.
And really, I was just totally turned on by that, you know? But what I was really used to was the other thing, you know, which is like, take what you can get from it.
Yeah.
And that's what you get, you know? And I think it's got its own blessing in there, you know, somewhere.
Yeah. The two of you started, you got to know each other, you started playing music together when you were still in high school. And also, as I read it, still before either of you had come out as lesbian to yourselves, much less to anyone else. And then I think you were two of the first real celebrities to be very open about your sexual orientation. And when I, you know, when I start to prepare to interview you, there are 100,000 articles online about you telling the story of how you came out to your parents, right? You know,
that's all people care about.
But I guess, you know, I don't want to ask you that story. I want to ask you how you start to see that trajectory of your lives and how important that was, you know, when you were teenagers, in this big picture of how the world is shifting now, you know, where we are now in 2013. You think about that?
You start.
Oh, no. So you mean in the context of queer
rights? Well, I guess
rights,
one thing I mean is, I don't know, maybe not 5 years from now, but 20 years from now, that might not even be a story that would be a big deal.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great?
Or you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's coming at some point. It's like Star Trek, you know, it's like, it's the next generation for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And,
Or Voyager.
Yeah, I mean, there's still so many, I mean, it's hard to envision it, honestly, because there's still so many areas and places where young people coming out, it's so hard still. There's so many people against you. There are some areas that, I mean, it's better than it was. There's no doubt about it. But I try not to look too far in the future because I feel like it's better to look at what's happening right now and there's still a lot of work to be done, honestly. But I hope there's a time. I know when we were in high school, it was the suburban South, you know, in Georgia, and we really didn't even know what gay meant. Like, we knew that it was a joke you made about your coach, honestly. That's all we knew.
Right, right.
That was it. Yeah. And then I fell in love my senior year with a girl, and I didn't even know what to call it. I was open about it because I was like, this is great. You know what I mean? But so I think we've come a long way in that there's the conversation. It's on TV. It's in popular culture. We're talking about it in our churches, one way or the other, whether it's bad or good, we're talking about it, you know, and that's the first step. And just hopefully we'll just take it a day at a time and just try to, it's all about neighbors, you know, it's about neighbors,
what?
Neighbors. It's one-on-one. Hmm. It's changing lives one-on-one. You know, I live in a rural town in North Georgia. It's pretty conservative. It's very conservative. And, the only way things change.
You live there still now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've lived there for 20 years. And the only way things change is when you get to know the person sitting next to you at the diner or at the meeting or at the cafe, whatever, wherever you are. And you may be really different from each other. And you make friends and you help each other out. And that's where the walls come down. I just find it to be like something that has to be a very one-on-one thing. I mean, I think, you know, obviously we're in the movement and we want to change things like that. But it's really changing in tiny little patches across the country, and we still need to be focusing on that, I think. You know, little high schools and little meetings, PFLAG and all that great stuff. That's very important still. And so I think I see my life as when I was in high school and not even knowing the language around it. And now there's all this language, and we can talk about gender even, you know, which is...
Yeah.
And there's the web, you know, the internet, which is the interweb, which is awesome, you know, because then somebody who can't be exposed to that language gets exposed to it, you know. Mm-hmm. So
there was something you wrote. I think you helped write this. It was, I believe, it was a cover to one of your albums that maybe you did on your own. In the mid-1970s, Amy Ray was a Georgia tween plucking out Partridge Family songs on her guitar and dreaming of becoming David Cassidy, the ardent teen idol who got all the girls.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't write that.
My ex-girlfriend
wrote that. I mean,
that's
XX.
Even better.
Yeah, she's a writer. She thought it was very clever, and I didn't have time to change it, you know. But I did love David Cassidy.
Now it's on public radio.
Yeah.
Forever.
I love him. I'll say it.
I was just going to make a comment about the just the queer rights and where we are now. And change is hard. And I feel like since the beginning of human history until the end of time, we're probably still all going to have to be working on accepting those who are different from us, you know? It's like it starts out as an evolutionary protection device. You have to be wary of that, which is different, just to make sure you're safe in your environment. But we screwed it up, you know? And I was just thinking yesterday, I'm getting married next week. Yay! But thanks. We're getting married. My partner's Canadian. We're getting married by a justice of the peace because we're afraid they're going to repeal the laws before we get a chance to, like... So we're going to hurry up and get married, and then we're going to have a ceremony. So, like, queer people, they have to... You can't do it the way you dream about it, really, you know? We had the kid first, and then... And it doesn't matter, how straight people do it, it's fine, but we haven't had the same privileges of, you know, chronology. So anyway... So we're going to get married, and then we're going to file that paperwork the next day, and then she'll get her green card if everything goes as we hope, and there you go. But she was so – yesterday she called Delta because we were booking some flights, and she referred to me as her wife to the agent. My whole body got tense. Here's what I thought. This agent hates her. This agent is not going to help her. This agent is immediately judging her. This agent, blah, blah, blah. And I was just, that is what is in me, you know, as much as I've been an activist and as much as I've been queer, you know, my whole adult life. I was just like, wow, the change has to come from within. It really does. Mm-hmm. And it takes a long time. And
even from within you.
Yeah, but I've allowed myself to be damaged by other people's judgments of me. And it's hard not to when you talk about the church, too. Holy cow, you're going to hell and all that. God bless the Pope, who at least came out and said, I can't judge gay people. I mean, that's change. But that takes, and Amy turned me on to this book, The New Jim Crow, by Michelle Alexander.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just about mass incarceration of African Americans, if you don't know that book. And it's the same thing. It's like... ways that we control people we're afraid of and how hard changes and how long it takes. So I'm so excited about being a wife, really. I like that word wife, personally. But my whole body tensed up, and I'm like, you know, it was a bad feeling.
How did the agent react?
Totally fine. Let me check that for you. One moment, please, you know? Yes, I can seat you two together. And then it, little by little... You realize that not everybody hates you. Well, I mean, I'm exaggerating. I know that. But you know what I mean.
Yeah. So you two definitely are in this lineage of music and social justice, social healing, social activism. I mean, we've been talking about this piece, about this sexuality piece, where there's a lot of change that's unfolding right now in real time. But I kind of want to ask you about how you think about social change in our time with, you know, I've been talking to some people here about who've been involved in the civil rights movement, and social change doesn't look like that now. You don't have it's not clear that you can have the leaders and the critical mass the way it worked 50 years ago. But on the other hand, we have technology. I'm just kind of curious about how you see that, this time we live in, and how change happens and how music can be part of that.
It's
huge
great,
question.
Great
okay, you
question.
Got it.
We should ask her how she thinks about it.
Yeah. How do you think about it?
No, that's against the rules.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It was Amy's idea.
We have rules here, too.
I think about...
It's like church.
But you know, yeah. more than we do about it.
I mean, I think it's an excellent, excellent thing to think about and talk about. I can't really wrap my mind around technology. I do know that I trust the media far less than I used to. There's so much information out there, and I think it takes a lot of energy to be vigilant.
Yeah.
And how do you even know where information is sourced from, and all those things? So, you know, back in the days, like, let's use the 60s or the anti-war movement, for example. I mean, it was easier in a way to consolidate a spirit and a movement. We were less distracted. We had less options, less avenues, less choice. The world seemed a simpler place, although humans weren't any simpler. But the world seemed a simpler place because we weren't bombarded. But also, like, technology now really brings to light. I mean, we wouldn't know about a girl who was shot in the face by Al-Qaeda. And maybe they weren't even Al-Qaeda. We don't even know that. They want us to believe that they're, you know, the enemies are everywhere out there in countries where people's
so,
skin
I mean,
are brown.
So, I mean, it's tricky because on the one hand, there's more. And on the other hand, you don't know what to trust.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. But it brings to light. I mean, I think the tools are as powerful, but maybe not more powerful than they ever were.
And you think about, you know, and I think about music, how music, you know, Vincent Harding, who was here, who was a civil rights leader, talks about how civil rights activists, there was this aspect of singing the way to freedom as much as it was about politics and marching. And you know, everything started and ended with singing, and singing was there all the way through. Or, you know, you figure like Pete Seeger in the 60s. So now you don't have that, but you do have technology that's so accessible, right? Your music is out there in ways that you could never have imagined it would be out there when you started singing together in high school.
But it's out there, and it's not the same, though, as a protest song that is not owned, but part of a movement, and so it's a different property. I don't know how to. It's like, there's so much about music that's become, I guess, secular rather than sacred in some ways, because I consider protest music sacred. And we, you know, like when you read about Woody Guthrie, and I was talking to a friend out there about this, traveling around from one union thing event to another, and migrant workers and all the things that were happening, and the music just being this thing that fueled all these stops. And I think that still goes on. To a certain degree, sometimes. But I think it's, we don't even write enough protest songs. We're still singing the same ones, you know, and they're great. But, like, we don't, it's not,
but
I don't
you
know what's
wrong. You write activist music.
Yeah, but it's not like, it's like you go to an SOA protest and you're like, what song should we sing? And, you know, Closer to Fine, but it's like, but there needs to be a We Shall Overcome, you know, of our. I mean, I've been talking to, it's funny, this whole last year I've had a lot of these conversations with activist friends of mine from different groups that are working in the undocumented workers movement and racism movements. And we all talk about that, too, you know, which is like we need to be writing songs and telling our stories now that are going on now. You know, and I know there are people doing that, but they're not getting heard. Because there is so much. And so it's like, how do we elevate those people? And how do these songs get heard? And how do we make them into the songs that are the songs of a movement? And
so
I don't know.
You're all asking those questions.
We're
and
asking
putting
it.
Those questions.
We don't know the answers. So
I know you know this, but, I mean, people's lives have been changed also by your music. You know, somebody was just telling me, somebody here who's from England, about hearing you the first time in Royal Albert Hall and 20 years ago, and
I think music can change people because it gathers us together, and it opens you up, and you know, like when we all sing Closer to Fine together as a crowd, we're having that right there is a revolutionary moment. The barriers are coming down. We're singing this song, and I agree with, like, I think that music is so powerful like that, but I also crave that, you know, writing This Land Is Your Land, you know, like writing a Pete Seeger song or a Woody Guthrie song. And
yeah.
You know what
no.
I mean? I mean, I'm not
yeah.
saying that.
No,
like,
I know. It's a...
Or, you know, any of the great gospel songs that have been taken by the movements in the past, you know, and having those. And I'm not saying, I'm just saying, like, I have yet to understand where we're at either, you know, because I think where we're at is as important as the civil rights movement in the 60s. You know, there's a cross-pollination of immigration reform movements and queer movements and poverty movements and hunger movement. They're all coming together and they're helping each other out. It's remarkable. And I think that there's something remarkable going on, but how do we sing about it? You know, is the question I have.
But
so y'all write some lyrics. Let's get
it's a great question to put into the world. Yeah.
I mean, I agree with everything that Amy said. You wrote a song, Let It Ring, that to me is as anthemic and powerful a protest song and a movement song as anything that's out there. We're not Bruce Springsteen, so not as many people hear it.
It's true, we're not.
What are the lyrics? What are some of the words?
It's okay. Let's sing it.
I mean, we can put it in on the radio, but sing it a little bit.
Well, it's Amy's song, but when I get down on my knees, the gist of it is I pray the same way that you do, and Let Justice Ring is the gist of the song. So, but I sort of think of it as a queer anthem as well, but it's not just for queer people. It's for everybody, whoever was judged. So it's very, very powerful. Always gets a very strong reaction. You can't fake that, you know, that visceral connection to what's really going on. That's when it doesn't go through your head first, you know?
Right.
Go straight to that thing.
Your body.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And Hammer and Nail.
Yeah.
What?
That's a total... What Emily songs, Hammer and Nail, that's...
There's so many lines in that song I would change.
Yeah, but it's a...
But
it's a
but it's the point of it, yeah. It is a movement song.
It's a movement song.
Yeah. I shouldn't have written it when I was that young, but...
I'm kind of amazed. When did you write Closer to Fine? How old is that?
Well, it came out in 89, but I probably wrote it in 87, 86 or 7.
I'm kind of amazed you could write that so young.
Yeah.
You know, when I read this, you know, I mean, and I wrote it, so I was getting ready to interview you, and then I heard the song, I couldn't get it out of my head, and then I heard it was on the radio, and I heard it again, and now I'm singing it constantly. But I mean, I printed out just, you know, this verse, we go to the Bible, we go through the workout, we read up on the revival, and we stand up for the lookout. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. The less I seek my source for some definitive, the closer I am to fine. I feel like that's what you
make
learn
it sound
as you
like
get
poetry.
It is poetry.
It's awesome.
Oh, it's awesome. Thank you for that. That's cool.
I just want to ask you if there's a song now or songs that, and maybe that people haven't heard yet, you have a new album out, but that really reflect, you know, how you're thinking now about what it means to be in the world.
Well, most of mine are Amy's songs. Like, I'm not kidding. I mean, I'll just say that they are mostly. And there are lines in Amy's songs, like in Shame on You. I just told her this the other day, but, you know, talking about immigration and the line, I think we were on the same boat back in 1864. I love that line. Like, same as it ever was, you know, and then Amy's got a song called Second Time Around that's just very much like don't compromise. It hurts if it hurts inside, and have some pride, and don't say anything mean. If you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all. Just things like that that I want to live by. And there's another song I was just thinking of. But yeah, I guess I don't have the same reverence for my songs as
you
I do
don't?
For hers. Nope.
Oh, for you don't have them for yours that you have for hers.
Yeah. Sometimes, like, I feel emotionally close to the song, but usually they're about, like, personal relationships. And I'll think, oh, that was a good image. I got that one. But it's not, this is really describes what's going on in the world and that sort of thing. Because,
You're forgetting some of your songs, possibly. Like... Like Let It Be Me, like Pendulum Swinger.
I mean, they're activists.
Hammer Nail.
I know, but I don't hook into those songs the same way. Maybe there's another reason for it.
It's easier to hook into the other person's song than to your own. That's just like the
really
way it is. Yeah. Well, it just works out that way.
Yeah, I guess so. Cause
that's why we're still together singing.
That's great. The secret of a healthy long relationship.
Yeah. Codependency. There's nothing like it.
Woohoo! Oh, there's so much we could talk about. We have to finish, and we have to finish before the heavens pour again. Here's a really lofty question, but again, I feel like you're up to it. This is a quote from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel in your book with your dad. You talked about religious music. I'd never read all that Heschel talking about religious music. Religious music is an attempt to convey that which is within our reach but beyond our grasp. I just want to ask you how each of you think about how music and music over time has formed your sense of what it means to be human and maybe even who God is, the image of God.
I mean, I'll just say a couple thoughts that come to mind. And one is that music is, it's physical, it's got, you know, your heartbeat, it's got rhythms, it's got space, it's a physiological reality along with a mystical reality, so it's metaphysical. There's not many things to in life you can point to and go, that's metaphysical, but music is, and in the most broad expanse of the word, you know. And also, like, there's another quote that Dad taught me, which is like, what is it? Music is praying twice or something like that. So I love that.
Good quote.
Yeah, I forget who said it. I'm sorry, but and it's just like Amy was talking about protest songs and how, you know, there have been protest songs that have bolstered the spirits, galvanized people in the midst of a very painful but positive movement, social change movement. And so it's such a powerful, powerful, powerful tool. So for me, it's been almost everything in the way I've been shaped. But people write music, and what you get out of music comes from the people. And it doesn't come from, it comes from everything that's happened before it. And I love that too. Mm. Like, I love that there's a continuum always and forevermore. And so that's how we can really sponge up the entirety of human existence is through music, because it's all, it's come from that, and will continue to. So, you know, it's almost everything to me. Shaped everything.
Yeah, me too. I'll go with what everything you said is absolutely true. The physiological thing, all that. It's funny because you can find God in music when you're gathered together singing a song, but also there are moments that I've had seeing people perform where it's just, that's God. It's like, they're not God, but God's there. It's like Patti Smith at Red Rocks, Prince, Purple Rain tour.
Heart.
You know, it's like these certain moments that are Rage Against the Machine at the Masquerade in Atlanta. You know, like there's just these moments, and it's not the personality of the musicians anymore. Something's disappeared, and the music and the audience and everything has merged, and there's no separation between performer and audience. That is what spirituality is supposed to be, no separation. And so, for me, it's formed everything, because that's what I've always strived for, is that, like, not to be that performer, but to, like, have those experiences at shows, you know, go to a show and have that experience. It's sweaty, and it's not beautiful. It's transcendent, though.
Okay. Those are great last words. We can't wait to hear you sing tonight. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. So I really do love your show. It's such a great show.
Oh, that means so
and
much.
I know, I'm
you.
Serious. It's
thank
such
you.
A great show, and thank you so much.
Thank you.